Speaker is Dale Workema. Dale Workema is a research geophysicist working in the Office of Research and Development, or ORD, for the Environmental Protection Agency. He's based in Corvallis, Oregon. He performs basic and applied research on geophysical response to various contaminants, remediation methods, and for conceptual site model development. Dale serves the EPA regions and offices on the application of geophysical methods to various contaminants and site-specific technical issues. Dale's been with EPA since 2002, and prior to that, he was in consulting and teaching while he was in his graduate studies. Okay, Dale, if you're all set, I'm going to turn it over to you. First, let me just make one last reminder to phone participants. Please make sure your phone stays on mute. And if you don't have a mute button on your phone, you can hit *6, but just please remember not to put us on hold. Dale, if you're ready, please start.
Okay, great. Can everyone hear? I guess I'm going to assume that everybody can hear me, but thank you for the introduction, Cindy and Jean, for setting this up. So as mentioned, today I'm going to give you a rundown on environmental geophysics, some applications for just environmental site characterization, some applications and sort of a rundown of some research on plume mapping and remediation monitoring, as well as some other applications and rundowns of some recent research for basic conceptual site model development as well. So, okay, so the first question is, why geophysics? Why should we really care? And I think a good analogy is in the medical imaging field, and that prior to expensive or invasive surgeries, most prudent surgeons and patients, for that matter, will utilize medical imaging tools to understand what's going on inside their body. And each tool or each medical imaging method is used for specific purposes, like, for instance, you break a bone, you're going to get an X-ray to see what happened to the bone structure in your body. But if you have other ailments that might be soft tissue related, you might get an MRI. The point being that each investigative tool is designed for a different purpose. And I'm trying to find my pointer here. My pointer live. Oh, there it went away. There it is. There we go. Okay, thank you. So just as in the medical fields, in geophysics or any investigation on the subsurface, it's prudent to try to understand what we can see under the ground prior to drilling or excavating or any other sort of expensive earth intrusive investigation, and that's where geophysics comes in. And traditionally, geophysics has been used for petroleum exploration or mineral exploration. Well, we can also use those same fundamentals for environmental type problems. And just as in medical imaging, each geophysical method or each geophysical technique is used for different specific purposes. Like here's an example on the left here that is a dipole-dipole resistivity survey that was used to find a low resistivity, electrical resistivity conductive plume here at a landfill. Here's another method here that's using a magnetic method to try to find abandoned wells where at the surface you can't see anything. So again, we use different tools for different objectives. So the outline for today's webinar, I'm going to first go through a little rundown on locating subsurface objects and infrastructure under the ground. We'll go through some examples of using geophysics for plume detection and monitoring different remediations, whether it be active or passive remediation. Also using geophysics for site characterization and model development. I'll give some examples of using geophysics to help understand groundwater-surface water interactions, and then I'll finish up with some online resources that are available for those who are interested or for practitioners to get more information. And again, as just I sort of outlined with the medical monitoring or imaging analogy, that geophysical methods is just an additional set of tools in a site investigator's toolbox. So one additional way to try to figure out what's going on at your site, or maybe additional tools to enhance what you already know. So let's start with finding underground storage tanks or other subsurface infrastructure. And this is important from an environmental perspective because, number one, you can often these objects are the source of any contamination. And in addition to that, the installation of these structures disturbs the ground, changes the porosity and the permeability, and can lead to preferential flow directions. So what we like to think about of geophysics is initially, what are the physical properties of the target? For instance, an underground storage tank or associated infrastructure. Is that target metal? Is it ferrous metal or non-ferrous? Is it fiberglass? And is there any potential interference from any surface structures? Is it a tank that's underneath the concrete floor that has a 3-inch by 3-inch rebar mesh? Those are similar, or that's a type of interference, or it could be electromagnetic noise interference that could attenuate an electromagnetic signal and cause problems for us to try to figure out what we're trying to find. So the likely applicable geophysical methods for finding underground storage tanks or any subsurface infrastructure are typically a magnetic method, an electromagnetic method, and ground-penetrating radar, which is technically a type of electromagnetic method. But if you look at the upper right of the screen, this is a picture of a cesium vapor magnetometer. And what magnetometers do is they're a passive geophysical method where we're actually detecting the Earth's natural magnetic field. But what happens is if there's something under the ground that has a high magnetic permeability, they will accentuate or attenuate the Earth's magnetic field. So in this case, you can see that the Earth's magnetic field lines are sort of attracted at sort of the north pole of this ferrous object, and they sort of are decreased or attenuated on the side of it and then increased again on the south pole. And what happens with the magnetometer surveys is that we're measuring the intensity or the intensity of these magnetic field lines. And you can see what we get is we get this response, which is sort of this dipolar response where we get a peak and a trough. So with magnetic surveys, we often look, depending on the orientation of the object under the ground, we look for these highs and lows to help try to find objects that we're looking for. If we move to the lower left of this slide, this is sort of the EM or electrical magnetic portion of the slide. What happens here with EM methods is that it's an active method where we are sending a primary electromagnetic wave into the subsurface, and objects in the subsurface that have electromagnetic or differing electromagnetic properties, a secondary EM wave gets generated, and the instrument measures that secondary wave, and it compares it to that primary wave, and we get two responses from this. We get a what we call an in-phase response, or the real component, and a out-of-phase or quadrature component. And those can be thought of, generally speaking, as the in-phase is sort of our metallic or metal detector, and the quadrature, or the out-of-phase, measures the bulk ground electrical conductivity. Throughout this webinar, I'll be using the term conductivity, in which case I mean electrical conductivity. I'm going to probably get lazy and drop electrical and just go with conductivity. And then over on the right is a picture of a ground-penetrating radar system, which is also another system good to try to find objects under the ground. So let's look at some examples. Here is sort of your typical gas station. Right in the center here was the dispenser island for the autos, and this over here is a dispenser island for all the big trucks coming in. And this is the magnetic survey. Again, that's a picture of the instrument right there. There's the sensor. And again, we're measuring the total magnetic field intensity of the Earth. So we're looking for things under the ground that may accentuate or attenuate the Earth's natural magnetic field. And you can see we get quite a big, that sort of high and low response around the dispenser islands all in here. This is an area in the back where there's some known underground storage tanks, so you can really see the response from those tanks. There's other objects at the surface. This was a different paved area, so the pavement is different. So we get this broad alterations in the mag response. another underground storage tank here, a bunch of poles on the surface. And then we had this area here, which was just asphalt pavement here, but we definitely have some highs and lows in this area. So that area attracted some attention. So we continue with this site looking with the electromagnetic induction method. And this is the in-phase component, and here's the out-of-phase of the quadrature component. So this is conductivity, and this is actually a ratio of the secondary wave to the primary wave. So it's a concentration in parts per thousand. You can see that the anomalies now become a bit more discrete. Here's the dispenser island where all the trucks go in. Here's the auto dispenser island. Here's the underground storage tanks again, some of the light poles and things. And here's our anomalous zone right here, which is now nicely defined as a rectangle. We can see it in the conductivity of the quadrature response. We can see that here. We can see associated piping going into the tanks, and these are the pictures of the tanks that were removed. And what it turns out this year was the foundation of the old service center, and it did have some remnant contamination in there, some oil and hydrocarbon contamination. So it was good that we found this area, and they were able to go and clean it up. And then the third method for finding tanks and things under the ground, this is an example of some ground-penetrating radar, underground storage tank and utility examples. This is up at the top. This is a 500 megahertz antenna example, and this is a 400 megahertz antenna example. And what we see here, what you can think of when you look at these, is you can think of these dark bands as positive values that are sort of coming out of the screen, and the lighter color bands would be sort of negative values that go back into the screen. So these are all sort of like squiggly lines coming in and out of the screen stacked up next to us. And as the radar energy is sent into the subsurface, we get a reflection based on objects under the ground that have an electromagnetic property contrast, like the dielectric constant, the electrical conductivity, or the magnetic permeability. And what we see when we have objects, and this is a hyperbola radar reflection due to an underground storage tank. Here's another underground storage tank here. We get these hyperbolas form as we cross over objects, as we drag these antennas shown on the upper right here, as we drag those along the surface of the earth. You can see also there's some pipes. We see evidence of pipes in here as well. And these are all oriented coming in and out of the screen. And down below with a bit lower frequency antenna, you can see we also have other objects as a telephone cable, some steel pipes here. So radar is really good to help find discreetly locate these objects. We can get a better idea of depth, but a good sort of scope of work or standard operating procedure for trying to find subsurface structures or anthropogenic objects is to first go across the site sort of as a reconnaissance tool with an electromagnetic induction instrument, and then you can follow up in areas that show anomalous zones with radar, because you only see in radar where you drag that instrument. So it gives you a nice picture of some subsurface structure as well as any objects that might be there. So now let's move on to using geophysical methods to map contaminant plumes. And I'm going to start with just DC resistivity. And this is where, and the picture up in the upper right shows what this is like in a field deployment. We have electrodes that go in the ground, connect wires to it, and what we do is we inject current, or we set up a very large voltage potential difference across two of those electrodes that drives a current into the ground. And we use other sets of electrodes to measure the voltage drop and how that earth filters out that current that it sends into the subsurface. And how the earth filters out that current is generally governed by Archie's law, which is shown over here on the left. And when there's no clay present, the effective resistivity of the earth, or the measurement that we are made at those voltage potentials, is directly proportional to a bunch of constants, which are basically representative of the geology, the porosity of the area where we're surveying, or the porosity between these two, our current dipole and our voltage dipole, how much of those pores are saturated, and most importantly, the resistivity of the fluid that's filling that pore space or the electrolyte. So what I'd like you to think about is that the effective resistivity that we measure is directly proportional to that fluid under the ground, and that's a good way to think about it when dealing with contaminant plumes. So when we do a survey in the field, here's our current dipole, again, where we're driving current into the ground. And then with, as shown in the picture at the upper right, we just move our voltage dipoles around. We can move them laterally, and we can go in and out of the page. And what we end up doing is we end up developing what we call a pseudosection, which is a lateral and a vertical distribution of the apparent resistivity, which you can effectively think of as sort of the average resistivity of the Earth at that particular point. And you can see we can contour it by color, so we can get a high resistivity zones here and lower resistivity zones, like up in here, moderate zones. So that's what it looks like in the field. So let's take, that's sort of the background theory of the method. So let's see what happens at a contaminated site. So we had the opportunity to go down to a barrier island in Louisiana after the Deepwater Horizon event, and try to see what the DC resistivity response would be to a fresh spill. So what was nice about this, and Jeff Heenan did this for his PhD work at Rutgers University, but it was an uninhabited barrier island, which was nice because there's no anthropogenic noise, so we didn't have any interference to deal with, and it was an opportunity to sort of study the fate and transport of this oil contamination. You can see where we're located. Here's Louisiana. This is the barrier island, and this is, these contours show the different degrees of oil as they hit the shoreline. So here's the picture in the upper left that shows the resistivity system, just like I showed you before. Again, this is where we were located, and these are the results, just like I showed you before, how the pseudosection or the geoelectrical section is created by acquiring the data from the electrodes. We can see here that this is really low resistivity, right, because we're in a saltwater saturated sand, so that electrolyte is going to be brine, which is going to really want to conduct electricity, so that effective resistivity that we're measuring is going to be generally very low. And here we can see a higher resistivity corresponding to that oil layer. So this is offshore, this is inland on the barrier island, and we can see blobs here or high resistivity zones, which corresponds to where Jeff was able to dig down here, and you can see where the oil displaced the pore space or filled the pore space, and that oil is electrically resistive. So we see a fresh spill coming onto this barrier island shows an electrically resistive response. You can see our depths. We were able to image relatively close to the surface, and it was really a nice, clean geology. It was just, you know, basically a sandbox with some oil. So what we were able to do is adapt that field system to a remote solar-powered acquisition system, and we can see here, what I show on the right here, is about 15 months of resistivity being collected, and here you can see that original plot of that resistive oil, and we've taken a ratio of our subsequent readings to that baseline, and you can see that over time in that area where that oil was impacted, we can see that it has either degraded or moved through the system. And we took a plot, we could plot the average resistivity or resistance over time. We can see that that has decreased over time as well through this monitoring regime. We were also able to pull some cores out and do some microcosm experiments to see if there was any degradation occurring. And you can see that it was pretty rapid. After about 10 days in, there was quite a decrease in the benzene or toluene concentration relative to the controls, with a couple of spikes as it sort of cycled through its process of degrading the oil. So we see potentially, this alteration in our resistivity sections over time is probably a combination of a degradation as well as fate and transport through that system. So let's go back up a little bit to some work that was done in the early 90s in a column experiment to try to understand what's the mechanism behind the DC resistivity response to oil contamination. So this was a controlled kerosene spill in a column. So we have depth here. So the column was about a meter and a half tall. And here, instead of resistivity, we take the inverse of that, which is conductivity. And when there was no kerosene added, that's the blue plot here, we can see that it's very low conductivity in this, in the vado zone of the column, right? Why is that? Well, that's because the conductivity, or this form of Archie's law, is showing resistivity, but the conductivity is really low, or the resistivity is really high, so then what we're measuring is going to be directly proportional to that. And as we transition down here into the transition zone and then into a saturated zone, we can see that the conductivity at depth is pretty uniform and consistent at about 5 millisiemens per meter. As more and more kerosene was added, you can see it's a light non-aqueous phase liquid, so it's depressing the water table. And what's happening is the conductivity is decreasing, very similar to what we see at the Deepwater Horizon spill, conductivity decreasing or the resistivity increasing as more and more kerosene was added. However, if we go to a field site, so this is a field site at a city park adjacent to a refinery that had shown leaking hydrocarbons for several decades. And what we were able to do is to install down here these instruments, which were basically an in-situ long-term e-log. And we basically just had a PVC pipe with a bunch of electrodes in it. So it was a dry well, and we could measure the conductivity with depth. And this is the uncontaminated location. So you can see, very similar to the column experiment, we have a very dry vadal zone or low conductivity. As we get to the water table, it increases as we go to the capillary fringe to a pretty uniform saturated zone. If we look over here on the left, this is the geology distribution. So the other components to Archie's Law, we can see that this area was almost all sand. That came off the legend there, but that's sand. And then if we compare this to the uncontaminated location, we pretty much have sand mostly throughout the whole section until we get into the saturated zone and get some more gravels present. But if we compare the geophysical response, here we have our dry vado zone, and then we have an increase in the capillary fringe, but what we see an increase in conductivity right at this zone, right above the saturated zone. So if we looked at the previous slide, I'm going to go back. What we saw at the previous slide was actually the opposite, right? We saw a decrease in the conductivity, whereas with this example, we see an increase in the conductivity. So to try to understand, and this also does not agree with what we saw at the Deepwater Horizon. What's different here is that this is a plume that had been around for several decades. So to try to understand the mechanism for this response, we brought some biologists in to help us understand what's going on. So this is the distribution of the elm apple in this column here. We can see that at the contaminated location, there's nothing up here in the vado zone, and then we get into some residual elm apple, some free, and so we have this smear zone as the water table goes up and down of residual and free, and we have some dissolved elm apple here as well. And if we compare that, so we also took some soil cores right next to where the probes are. This is our water level indicator. That was our e-probe, and then we would go in, and the biologist would just take continuous cores, and the legend here is wrong. This should be clear. This is basically what we saw at the uncontaminated site with some common soil bacteria. But at the contaminated site, we can see that the microorganisms or the population there has naturally selected to include a whole bunch of hydrocarbon degraders and iron and sulfur reducers. So we see a relationship between the microbial population, the oil contamination, and the geophysical response. So to further understand that, try to figure out what's going on here, we took an experiment and tried to replicate this in the lab. These are some about 1 foot diameter, 3 foot tall soil columns. They're duplicates of each. Some were inoculated with microbes, some were not, some had oil, some were not. And if we look here in the red plot, this is the distribution of the elm apple. So here's our free product zone. And this is the response in the lab, subtracting away background. So this is a percent increase in conductivity. And we can see in the lab, we do see an increase in the conductivity associated with the presence of the elm apple and the presence of microbes, as these were the columns that had that included. In the field site, plotted up there, we see a very similar thing. We see about 300%, a little bit over, increase in conductivity at the field site, as well as about a 300% increase at the lab in the conductivity. And we can see that those are associated with the presence of the elm apple. In the geochemist, if you saw on the side of these columns, these like red stripes, that was just a complete septum where we could insert a hypodermic needle and withdraw fluid at different heights or different depths in the column. And you can see in the lab versus the field for both the calcium ion concentrations and dissolved inorganic carbon, we see quite an increase when there is elm apple present. And then the biologists, we had cores pre-packed in those columns, so we could just pull them out at set times during this experiment. And we can see that in the contaminated columns, the gene communities really naturally selected to oil degraders. So what we see is we see an increase in the oil degraders. We see an increase in the ionic content of the pore fluid at the same locations where we see an increase in the conductivity. So the geophysical response we find is coincident with microbial and geochemical changes. So you can think of the geophysical monitoring of a plume that's naturally degraded as sort of a proxy measurement for those microbial activities and or microbial processes and the resultant change in the pore fluid content, as seen here in the dissolved calcium ion. But what DC resistivity doesn't really tell us is what's happening to the solid component of the soil or the earth, or in this case of the sand column, because as you recall from Archie's law, what we're measuring is really directly related to the electrolyte or the pore fluid content. So to try to understand what's happening along the fluid solid grain interface, we can use another geophysical technique called induced polarization or spectral induced polarization. And what happens in here is that when we drive when there's no electric field placed around a sand grain, the charges are balanced, but when we apply electric field, those charges migrate to one side. We can turn off that field as shown here, and as we turn it off, there's a decay as those charges equilibrate. We can measure that decay, we can integrate underneath that curve, and we can measure the chargeability or like the capacitance of that area in the earth, and we can see how chargeable it is. We can do that in the time domain. We can also do that in the frequency domain, looking at the phase shift from the voltage and the current that we send and receive. From that, we can measure two things. We can measure the real conductivity, which is that electrolytic component from Archie's law, but we can also measure the autophase or the quadrature component, which gives us an idea of what's happening on the surface of that grain, the surface area, tortuosity, and different physico-chemical property changes at the fluid-grain interface. This method is really used quite successfully to find clays or fine grain materials as that increased surface charge density because of the fine grains. You can really find it well with induced polarization. And it's a method that can be acquired at the same time or the same field layout as a DC resistivity section. It just takes a bunch more time to measure this decay curve. So what do we learn when we add this? Well, here's a field site where our zone of hydrocarbon impact. Again, here's your DC resistivity section. Here's our low resistivity or high conductivity saturated zone. Here's the transition zone of the capillary fringe. Here's a dry vado zone which has a high resistivity. And here's our zone of hydrocarbon impact where we have an of a mature site that's undergoing degradation, and we have an increase in the resistivity relative to equal or correlation corresponding betasome. So what we were able to do, and Gamal did this work, Gamal Abdelal, the lead author in the paper here, took a bunch of samples, put them, inoculated some, and others he kept as control, put them in a laboratory experiment, and measured that imaginary conductivity, again, looking at that surface conduction mechanism. And you can see versus a control, which is the blue line here, in the experimental column, we see quite an increase in that surface conduction mechanism. And if we compare that to the cell growth, we can see relative to the control column, we can see the red here shows an increase in the cell populations as well. Scanning electron microscope images of the control column doesn't show much etching in the soil grains, but if we compare that to the experimental column, we actually get a development of all sorts of biofilms and etching, which may help to understand the mechanism behind our electrical response. And not only is the electrolyte becoming more conductive, but there's alterations at the soil grain, which is also changing our geological response. So here we understand more about the mechanism of that. An additional geophysical method we can measure that we've been experimenting with is magnetic susceptibility. And John Wilson found that there is a relationship between chlorinated solvent degradation rates and magnetic susceptibility. You can see this relationship here through different microorganisms breaking down different chlorinated solvents. So to help test that theory, some colleagues went out to the Bemidji site. And this is the sort of map view of the Bemidji, Minnesota pipeline spill. And you can see here there's a little X right there, and there's an X prime there. So this is the profile through X to X prime exploded up on top of the slide. And this is Y prime going in that direction. I'll show you on the next slide. But what we can see here is you can see the location of the free product. And as we get more distal, you can see that we get more into the dissolved plumes here. This is the picture on the left here shows the downhole magnetic susceptibility tool. And you can see as we go downhole, we see that there's quite a big peak in the magnetic susceptibility right where we have the free phase plume and even some of the dissolved plume. And as we go further down gradient, where we get outside of that in the dissolved plume, we don't see quite a high amplitude magnetic susceptibility response. If we go in the other direction, from Y to Y prime, we can see really well going across that plume, we can really see that peak, and we can see where that magnetic susceptibility peak occurs is right between the high and the low water table. We can compare the free phase plume to the dissolved phase plume, and you can see that the magnetic susceptibility values in the free phase is much higher than in the dissolved. And we can also see that the free phase plume is also gives us a higher magnetic susceptibility in this water table fluctuation zone or above that water table zone. So what we're seeing here is that the water table fluctuation zone is the most biogeochemically active, as what's happening here is the microbes are altering the mineralogy of the site and actually reducing iron and giving us a higher magnetic susceptibility. So again, we have a carbon source which is inducing microbial activity which is altering the physical properties of that particular site. So this is sort of a summary slide that Estella Ottaquana put together, where there's basically we can, given microbes, some organic carbon, nutrients, and a mineral substrate, productions of biomass can include, which I showed you in that SEM slide. We can have generation of metabolic byproducts, like we saw the increased calcium ion and the dissolved inorganic carbon. And we can see biomineralization, which I just showed you at the Bemidji site. All these things can lead to physical chemical changes, such as changes in the surface geometry of sediment grains, which we can measure with is possible to measure with IP-induced polarization, which I showed you. We can see changes in fluid chemistry, which is like the DC resistivity response to that, and then enhanced mineral precipitation, which we see with the magnetic susceptibility. And all of these things, again, as I just said, can be measured through different electrical methods. I didn't show you any seismic but I will show you some SP and GPR in the next few slides. So this work through the past decade or plus has sort of led to a new sort of subdiscipline in geophysics called biogeophysics, where it's the geophysical investigation of microbial processes and interactions in the earth, where we can use geophysical methods to detect or monitor microbial activity and their byproducts and their impacts and interactions with the subsurface. So it can be used, as I showed, for monitoring or direct detection of different reactions that are happening, and even guide microbial sampling and identify where those biogeochemical hot zones are. So if we so those examples I gave you previous were just passive natural attenuation sites. The next few slides, I'm going to give you some examples of a site that's undergoing active remediation. And this is a really good example. It's a former fire training facility in Oscoda, Michigan, where large quantities of fuel were burned in the 90s and resulted in a pretty thick free product layer. And what I'm showing here is self-potential. And this is a geophysical method where we can we actually measure the Earth's natural voltage potential, which is indicative of redox changes and different fluid chemical alterations in the subsurface. And in 1996, before a soil vapor extraction system was put in, at this location of the, on the plume, SP or self-potential survey was performed, and you can see that there are these highs of high voltage potential. Again, this is indicative to would be a high electrical conductivity associated with exactly where this plume is located. Well, 11 years later, after the soil vapor extraction system completed working, we can see this is a similar grid. You can see that the those highs from the SP response are gone. Now, we don't see that high connectivity response or that high voltage response from the SP data. I also have some data here of with DC resistivity from in 96, 03, and 07, and also with GPR through those same times. We can see in 96, the DC resistivity section, we can see this elevated conductivity or low resistivity zone associated with the plume. And as that SVE system functions, we can see that connectivity is reducing. And then here to where we get, this is what we would say in geophysics, this is sort of a typical unconsolidated sand aquifer response, where we have our saturated zone, low resistivities through our transition zone and our dry vato zone. If we look at the GPR, the ground penetrating radar response, we can see that when the plume was pretty active, there's a I lost my pointer. You can see that there's a bit of a shadow zone in 1996. You can see that we can really see a strong this is the reflection from the water table, okay, because it has a high electromagnetic impedance from the vato zone to the saturated zone, so we can see that really nicely with radar. However, you can see here there's what we call a shadow zone, because that electromagnetic energy is getting attenuated by this high conductivity zone over here. And as time goes on, you can see that in this area we're starting to get a little bit more energy penetrated, and down in here we can see that now we're getting reflections below that water table. It's a little bit more muted down here, but we're definitely have removed that white non-aqueous phase liquid that's floating right by the water table. So those are the examples, pretty much most of the examples of using geophysics to find plumes or monitor remediation, with a little run through on some of the research that I've been involved with and that a lot of my colleagues have been doing. Next, I've got some examples of using induced polarization for landfill investigations. These are some slides courtesy of Norm Carlson. This is a landfill, as you can see from the aerial in Tucson, Arizona, where you can't see anything from the surface. And what was done was a whole bunch of east-west IP-induced polarization lines. You can see that there are several zones of very high chargeability throughout this site. And if we look closely at a few of those sections, and over about a 10-year time after some enhancements were injected into the site to induce microbial activity, we can see in 1999, before any biodegradation was occurred, there's some a very large, broad chargeability zone, as shown by the red. So these are areas where the Earth is storing that electrical energy that we are putting into the ground. Or in other words, you can think of this as a capacitance. There's a high capacitance in the ground. And after 10 years of biodegradation, we can see how that's changed. We can see now the geophysical response has just been reduced to these little bit of air, these little zones here, and we can see that the effect of that IP charge, which is due to the landfill material, has really been reduced. And we can these are just 2D sections, but we can put that into a 3D, and we can begin to 3D map these zones and get a better idea to understand what's in the subsurface. Again, you can think of this as sort of a medical image of the Earth. So now we know where to perform surgery or where we might monitor. So generally, this is a conceptual model to sort of illustrate the temporal behavior of, in this case, bulk electrical conductivity, but hopefully the previous slides have convinced you that it also holds for magnetic susceptibility or other geophysical methods, is that at some initiation or there's some measured parameter. In this case, I'm using electrical conductivity. There's initiation of some contamination where the mass increases, and then the conductivity would drop, just like the Deepwater Horizon or that initial column experiment I showed you. And as biodegradation occurs during this zone, or as some active soil vapor extraction occurs, the contaminant mass is going to reduce in size. The conductivity, in this case, would increase to some peak conductivity, and then it would go back down to some background condition after the mass is removed, and any alterations to that subsurface that are measured in a bulk sense with the geophysics are going to revert back to normal. So in addition, I wanted to just include a couple of slides showing how some work that Lee Slater has done and some other colleagues have done how we can really use geophysics to really get a high resolution characterization in 2, 3, and even 4D in monitoring 3D of different processes in the subsurface. And these are some downhole, similar to that original slide I showed you of those in situ e-logs. Well, here's several downhole sections that are put in, and we can actually, instead of just measure the electrical distribution from electrodes at the surface of the Earth, we can put them downhole and compare across them and create tomographic sections. And then, so this is an example of just the 1D. Here's the anomalous zone, and we can piece it together. And this is an example of using downhole and tomographic electrical resistivity to monitor a amendment distribution in the subsurface. This is a great example of using IP downhole for lithologic imaging, where we can see areas of sand and gravel and silt, and the gamma log will give us some distribution of that grain size distribution, but we can see that the imaginary component, right, the component of that induced polarization response, that responds to smaller grains and charges on those grains, like, for instance, clays and silts, we can really delineate those, whereas the sort of the electrolytic conduction mechanism, we can't see any distribution or distinguish those silts and clays. However, when we start measuring the chargeability of the subsurface, we can really begin to discern those areas that might serve as important characterization for a fate transport study, for example. This is an example of a paper that's just about to come out of using radar to image burrows, animal burrows in the subsurface. And this is really interesting to get an idea, in addition to finding underground storage tanks or different piping and utility trenches, while also animals in different burrows can alter subsurface porosities and permeabilities and can actually create heterogeneities and anisotropy for fluid flow in the subsurface. So all these little reflections are traces of different alterations, electromagnetic property alterations in the subsurface caused by animal burrows. And the next slide shows it pretty nicely. These are groundhog burrows, and you can see up here, we can see the entrance to the burrow, the tunnel, the ramp, the chamber. We can look at those in all different directions, and then we can begin to take manual picks on off the top of these and begin to generate a little tunnel system so you can see exactly where this high permeability zone or these voids might be, which might help your characterization of a particular site. And notice this is, you know, within the upper half meter or about a meter in the subsurface, so it's pretty high resolution near surface to get an idea of heterogeneities in the subsurface. But this is a great example of using a 400 and a 900 megahertz ground penetrating radar antenna. Okay, now I'm going to transition into using geophysics for groundwater surface water investigations, and this is predominantly a lot of work that's been done by colleagues with the USGS, and I'm going to show you some examples using different geophysical methods, but predominantly using fiber optic distributed temperature systems. The way this works, here's the fiber optic cable here. This is the instrument, and basically the laser pulse is sent into the fiber, and the backscattered light is then analyzed back at the system here, and the time it takes that light to return is used to determine the location of different temperature events, and the intensity of it helps us understand the temperature changes. We can remove any diurnal variability and really get an idea of where temperature changes are occurring right along that cable. So how does this work with groundwater surface water investigations? Well, here's a picture of a cable in a shallow stream up at the top here, and here are some results. And you can see this, again, any sort of surface temperature changes have been taken away, and we can see that along this stream, there's not much change in the temperature until we see a dip right here, and this is the location where there's colder water being discharged into the river at this particular distance along the fiber. We can get an idea of flows coming up through the base or through the side of the rivers that alters the temperature and gives us an idea of where groundwater may be entering a surface water body. Here's an example where the USGS laid out a fiber optic grid offshore. And we can measure that thermal changes over time, and you can see that there's a cool thermal anomaly right here attributed to an area where there's some tributary entering the surface water body. So it's a great tool. You can see here the cable laid out, and this is when they were putting it in the water. Great tool to try to understand those dynamics at a particular site to get an idea, pinpoint where temperature anomalies might be entering a surface water body. This is another good example of monitoring a geochemical barrier, and you can see all sorts of little temperature anomalies to get an idea of fluid flow or temperature fluxes that need to be further investigated to understand the dynamics at this particular site. And we can also use handheld forward-looking infrared images to sort of as a reconnaissance tool to try to come up with ideas that might be cold areas or hot areas. We can identify different seepage plumes and then might be able to do, you know, use this or even in a UAV platform to try to narrow down or pinpoint areas that might need further investigation with a fiber optic tool. This is just an example of using UAV photogrammetry processing to get a detailed topography of a site. Okay, excuse me, I had to take a drink of water. This is an example, in addition to using temperature to try to understand stream dynamics, this is an example of using electromagnetic induction. Again, remember, same as I showed you, where we send a primary wave, measure that secondary wave. We can put it on a non-conductive kayak in this example and just go down the stream and measure the conductivity. And this was some work done in Moab, and you can see that we get zones of high conductivity and low conductivity, which can give us an idea of the electrolyte and how we can have fresh groundwater coming in, or in this case, mapping out more conductive groundwater due to the location of the a brine. So this, used in conduction with, or in conjunction with thermal imaging, can really give us an idea of understanding stream dynamics and how groundwater may be influencing or interacting with surface water. And finally, the last part of this webinar, I'm going to go into some online tools that are available via EPA and as well as USGS. I do a lot of collaboration with them. This is the front page of EPA's new environmental geophysics web presence, which is currently under development or under review at this time. And as I say, once it's finalized, it will be located at this site. But right now, the beta version is located at this Kluin site, as shown down at the bottom of the screen. But essentially, the resources section is an online textbook. It's also going to include some decision support tools, some forward models for geophysics and inverse models, and it should be a good reference for people to try to understand if geophysical methods might work on their site, or if they just want to learn a little bit more about geophysics. So I've got some examples of those. This is if you were to, I'm going to go back real quick. If you were to click on surface methods right here, what happens is the site takes you to this, basically the online textbook, which you can dive into all these different geophysical methods and learn a lot about them. You can see all these. We've got borehole geophysical methods, which Don Bussey is going to give a webinar on this Thursday, the 18th. Marine, there's electrical methods, which I covered a lot of as part of surface methods. And then there's also a big section on different geophysical properties, and you can begin to understand, okay, different methods measure different properties, just like x-rays do bone and MRIs do soft tissue. Different tools for different objectives. The geophysical decision support system, this is some screen grabs of the beta version, which again is available at this Kluin site. And basically what the decision support system does is it queries the user what your objective of the geophysical method might be, like for instance to map anthropogenic objects or find or develop your conceptual site model. And then it queries, these are all just a bunch of different windows, so this would be the first window that pops up. You begin to answer some questions. What's the geologic conditions, what's the land surface light at like, and after going through a bunch of windows, the system kicks out some geophysical keywords that are directly related to the answers to your question. It's also going to pull up relevant recent peer-reviewed publications, so that if you wanted to learn about something that might be, like for instance, induced polarization measurements on unconsolidated sediments at a site undergoing active degradation, you could pull that paper and learn more about it. The system also links back to different geophysical methods based, again, on the answers to the questions, what might be the most applicable geophysical method for your particular problem, and then it links back to the online textbook. In addition, if I go back, let's see if I can scroll back a little bit, back to the home page. So that decision support, that tool, once the updated version is available, will be available here. But if you were to go to forward models or eventually to the inverse models, you'll come to some tools as such. So this is the Fractured Rock Geophysical Method Selection Tool. This was developed by in collaboration with the USGS, and Fred DeLewis is going to be giving a talk a little bit on this, I believe, and more on another tool that I'll show you on Monday the 29th. So I'm going to briefly go through these. But this is the, again, Fractured Rock Method Selection Tool, where a user, you can't, probably can't see it very well, but on the left side, you enter your site conditions of what you're trying to do, and it comes up, it generates this table of what the most applicable tool is for your particular fractured rock objectives. We also available is a tool to input temperature data and other characteristics, and then it'll input or output different physical properties of your site, like your hydraulic conductivity or your porosity, based on, again, different point data that you input and different models that can get generated to help you interpret temperature data. This is the tool that that Fred's going to elaborate on, but this is the, if you go through the decision support system and it says, oh, you should use electrical resistivity, then you could then go to the, this, follow the link to this tool, which is the scenario evaluator for electrical resistivity, where you enter a conceptual model of what you think your site is, again, your gross understanding of it, assign some physical properties to that model, and then a true resistivity model is generated, and other errors can be introduced, and then a final model can be generated, or a synthetic resistivity image can be generated based on what you input on your site, what you think the resistivity structure is, what you think the contaminant is. Like, here's an example. Okay, here's the Bados zone, the Elmapple plume, this is a saturated zone. So after assigning different resistivities to all those different nodes, you would get a response, and then you could look at that and say, okay, based on what I know about my site, this could be a promising tool. And I could even alter my acquisition parameters, put a borehole electrode in, and see what might be the best field acquisition parameters to give me the results I need. So it's what we call a forward model or a predictive model to see if that, if this particular method would really work at your site and may warrant a pilot study to at the particular site and to understand it a little bit more. And let's see. Okay, so the next few slides are the last ones I have, and this is the a little bit more of a development of a recent tool called Moisture EC that Neil Terry at the USGS put together. And what our goal was to try to understand landfill degradation and performance. It's really important and critical to understand landfill moisture content and distribution. Well, of course, we can't go drilling a bunch of holes into a landfill. So our idea it was to use electromagnetic induction on the surface of a landfill, calibrate that with some known data, and in developing this model, we used nuclear magnetic resonance and generate a model or some code to determine water content from surface electromagnetic data, and develop a software that can be added to the forward modeling tools available, soon to be available online. So this is sort of a rundown where you can input your electrical conductivity data derived from an EM survey, insert some maybe point soil moisture data that you have, estimate the electrical conductivity and fit that data to some Archie's law parameters, and then moisture distribution can be generated. Different data can be weighted differently, and then the final solution is this soil moisture estimate that combines all these data to get an idea of what the soil moisture distribution is at this particular site where you'd enter these known points, estimated points. Neil put together a really nice graphical user image or interface where you can upload all your data, enter any gridding or development parameters in your model and or your Archie parameters, and then the data would then get generated, and errors in the error map can be produced so that you can get an idea of the uncertainty of your model. And Neil's also included 3D synthetic examples where here's your true moisture model, the inverted EM data calibrated with some moisture point data, and then we can generate a three-dimensional resulting moisture estimate using this moisture EC application. So, in summary, hopefully I've convinced you that we can use geophysical methods to characterize and monitor and find subsurface objects. We can use it to directly detect some contaminants like the Deepwater Horizon spill. We can use it to monitor and detect active and passive remediation like I showed you from the soil vapor extraction site, and that landfill site. And working with the geochemists and the biologists, I gave you a rundown of sort of the background early stages of biogeophysics to where the biogeophysical or the geophysical response is a sort of a proxy measurement or resultant of the biogeochemical reactions and interactions that happen at a contaminated site. I gave you some examples of using geophysics for high-resolution conceptual site model development, as well as monitoring dynamic hydrogeologic processes for groundwater-surface water interactions, and then I showed you some examples of the decision support systems. But ultimately, I think a good takeaway is to note that the geophysical response that we measure at the surface is a function of the geology, hydrogeology, biology, and chemistry of the subsurface. You know, these geophysical methods are not plume detectors. They're not tank finders. We're measuring the physical property changes that occur in the subsurface. And are those changes significant enough that we have instruments that can detect that resolution and measure the difference? So the thing to think about with if you're thinking about using geophysics or interpreting it, is to try to understand what are the physical property contrasts and are they detectable. And finally, I want to list all the collaborators that I've had the pleasure to work with, a big group at the USGS, Rutgers, and several universities, as well as a whole handful of students. And at that, I think I'm done, and I will take any questions.
Yeah, you're not quite done. We've got a few questions coming in for you, Dale. Thanks for that presentation. First off, let me ask you to hop back to one of your earlier slides. There's some confusion about the relationship between conductivity or resistivity with looking at LMAPL and petroleum contamination. So give me just a second. I'm going to pull up this slide. I think this will help. It was back in maybe, okay. So if you could, while I try and cue this up, while I'm looking for the right slide, can you just discuss what you're going to see with LMAPL contamination, like in terms of how your conductivity or resistivity would change?
Okay. Well, so broadly speaking, the first thing we need to do is understand the geology that we're in. Okay, so most of the examples I showed you were very relatively simple, well-sorted sand. And in this example right here, so the reason I say that is because when we think of the effect of resistivity or what we measure, it's directly proportional to, and you can think of this whole block here, the porosity and the permeability and these constants, that's dependent on the geology. And what's real important with LMAPL is this term right here, which is the pore water conductivity or the electrolyte that's really conducting that. So if we have a really conductive brine, like at the Deepwater Horizon spill, we had a really low resistivity or high conductivity. Now, in this particular case, on this slide, what we had was this blue plot right here shows clean sand response. Okay, this is the response conductivity with depth that we would expect to see when there's no contamination. Well, when contamination, or in this case kerosene, was injected, what happened was the conductivity decreased. Why is that? Well, that's because kerosene has a high conductivity or a low resistivity, so that's going to initially pull that down and be really low. Whereas if we look at this plot right here, or maybe, well, yeah, let's look at this one here on the right. Now, that was fresh spill. That was fresh kerosene. In the Deepwater Horizon case, it was also fresh oil. Well, this is a case at a landfill that had been degrading for about 20 to 30 years. So what happened is over time, the microbes, and at the next slide showed that when we included the gene community distribution, what happened is the natural soil microbes naturally select, and all the oil degraders, the alkane degraders, jump up and start chewing away at that carbon source. Due to that, their metabolic processes increases the cation or the calcium ion concentration. So what does that do? That increases the conductivity of the pore fluid. So with depth right here, we get an increase in the conductivity that occurs right where the oil is, where the bugs are chewing it apart, and where their metabolic processes etch the aquifer grains and increase the total dissolved solids of that pore fluid, and geophysically we see an increase in the conductivity. So if you have a fresh spill, like the Deepwater Horizon spill, it will be, what we find is electrically resistive response. Whereas if it's a plume that's been around for a while, or a plume that's undergoing active biodegradation or remediation, we see an increase in the conductivity, so it's the exact opposite. So what would happen if we could see a plume that stays stationary over time is initially it's electrically resistive, and over time it becomes conductive, and then it reaches a background response. So hopefully that answers the questions.
Okay, it clarified it for me. I hope that went through. Let's see. Our next question. Got a couple people asking about, well, it looks like a lot of the examples you used were for LNAP or other petroleum sources. What kinds of geophysical methods are more often used for VOCs or DNAPLs?
So for DNAPLs, as you know, they're sinkers. So initially, the role that geophysics can really play is to perform high-resolution conceptual site model development to really understand where that DNAPL may be trapped, where fine-grained lithologic boundaries might be included, and for that you could use like an induced polarization method or a seismic method that might really help you discern those fine-grained sediments. So the first pass with geophysics at a DNAPL site is to really understand the geology, so that as one would go drilling and poking in the subsurface, they're not going to move it deeper, and they can position that as prudently as possible with as much information we can of the subsurface. And then the slide that showed the abiotic degradation rates and the relationship between chlorinated solvent degradation and magnetic susceptibility, I think that's, as far as monitoring chlorinated solvent degradation, that's a promising avenue, as well as these other electrical methods too, because there will be a bulk electrical method change, because again, we're not detecting the contamination with geophysics. We're detecting the impact of that contamination in the particular geologic setting. So we're interested in trying to identify the mechanism behind how the physical property changes are going to occur. And that's one of the reasons why I went through a detail of the hydrocarbon response, is to show that it's a function of time, and it's a function of the geology, and it's a function of the metabolic processes and or any active remediation process that goes into the subsurface, so that we're measuring that, or geophysicists are measuring responses that take into account all those different changes. So with chlorinated solvent identification, number one, it's going to displace the electrolyte and fill the pore space. So it may, again, depending on the geology, it may give you an altered electrical response. But if nothing else, you use geophysics to understand the geology. And then as it breaks down or as it's remediated, understanding the biogeochemistry of that process can help you understand the mechanism, which could then understand the physical property alterations that could be caused and therefore detectable. If you look back at one of the slides that had the, I guess I could advance these, huh? There's your degradation rates of chlorinated solvent. There, this one right here. Oops, I went too far. Uh-oh. Got to be patient. There it is. So that's something, this is a good summary slide to try to understand, you know, what we measure geophysically and the different alterations that occur, that can occur, that we're detecting and may alter those petrophysical properties that are detectable geophysically. So hopefully people are nodding their heads in understanding.
I'm getting nods via the Q&A pod. So
okay, yes, good.
So we had talked before the webinar, Dale, about you maybe queuing up the GDSS example to walk some people through that. Do you want to do that for a minute here?
I could try.
Gene, can we queue that up for Dale?
Oh, what you're seeing. Uh-oh, my password did expire.
Oh, okay.
I can go to the CLUIN site.
There you go. When all else fails, we're always there.
Yes. The other site's under development for those who are listening, and it's not really approved for prime time either, and it's got a bunch of password protections that times me out pretty rapidly. Okay, so what do I need to do? Share my screen?
Yep, we're going to have you share your screen again, Dale, making sure you pick the right monitor. And then in just a moment, the audience will be able to watch. As soon as you can see Dale's screen, feel free to send in a quick message in the Q&A confirming that you've got visuals on his screen. So, Dale, I'll just let you know that I can now see what appears to be your mouse cursor hovering over some stuff. And there it is. So I can see the cleanup window. You just have to drag it up, make it a little bit bigger. And people are chiming in that they can see. So exactly, I might stretch that window out. And feel free to go ahead and demonstrate the tool now that we've got it up on the screens.
Okay. So full disclosure, I've been working on the new site, and I haven't been on this one in a while. But I showed you the home page in the talk, and basically the CLUIN site was an earlier version of it. But if you click on, well, briefly, we've got a few minutes. Let's see here if that works. We didn't test any further than just seeing if we could see it. Oh, there we go.
I got it in support.
Okay, cool. Is that working?
Yep. Looks like.
Okay,
got
so
it.
This is what I. This is sort of like what I said. The sort of online textbook, so to speak. So this is borehole geophysical methods. This is what, like I said, Don Bussey is going to be, or Busey is going to be talking about on Thursday, this Thursday. If we scroll down, there's marine methods, here's surface. So this is like what I talked about. So we could go to resistivity methods. Let's not wait for that to pull up. We'll do another webinar once the new site is up and live. But anyway, so this is goes into a big description of different resistivity methods, how it all works, different arrays and things. Again, just sort of like an online textbook, picture of some of the instrumentation, things like that. So that gives you a flavor for the online textbook side of things. And then, let's see if this works here. We go to decision support. So this is what I call the GDSS, the decision support system. And this is just the beta version. We'll see if it works. There we go. All right, cool. So we have our little disclaimer. And we press next. So this is where you can figure out, let's see, what do we want to do? Well, let's say, okay, we want to find underground storage tanks. So we want to map and locate anthropogenic objects. So we go next, and we say we want to find underground storage tanks. Go next, and this, we're pretty sure this is really old, so they're metallic. And we can give it a name. This is our test. We say next, and then we want to get an idea of what the geology might be. So let's say this is a temperate climate, and let's say this is a sort of suburban location, and we've got basically unconsolidated sediment. And we're thinking that the tank is probably within, the top of the tank is probably 10 feet below ground surface, and yes, there is going to be other man-made features, which are going to be there. We could say, oh, well, there's pipes and there's roads. So we say next. We'll say there's no. I'm keeping it simple, so because if you put in more complicated answers, it'll keep asking you more questions. So I'm trying to keep it simple. yes, we know that there's pipes and there's underground utilities, and let's just say we know that there's electric, that's all we know. And what the surface will say is asphalt, and it's flat. Okay, so now it gives us some warning. It's going to tell us that some methods aren't going to work. It's saying, so the method that's got the highest hits was ground penetrating radar or magnetic methods, or and these other ones are lesser likely to help us out. So for instance, if you want to learn about that, we could click on that, and that would take you back to the online textbook. And let's see, okay, so now we go to, where do we go? Oh, here we go. Sorry. This is laid out differently than what I'm used to. And this should generate a list of citations. There we go. Here's a list of some citations that might be relevant to your findings. This is pretty old, so I have not kept this updated. Here are some keywords on methods that will likely work, and then we can get a summary of the answers that you put in. The newer tool is a bit more dynamic, and these citations are not up to date. The newer tool, I try to update the citations monthly. The logic behind this is what it does is it takes the references that get input into the system, and it parses those references for keywords and titles. So as you're answering these questions, it's linking those references to the answers to your questions, so that when the results kick up, you're going to see, you know, publications that might be a month old. And it will also, in addition to giving you these methods, it will give you links to some of those forward modeling tools, like the scenario, the evaluator for electrical resistivity that Fred's going to talk about in a couple weeks. So again, this is about a 5 to 8-year-old beta version, but the it gives you a flavor for how it works.
Okay, yeah, a couple of people did ask specific questions about, you know, I'm guessing that they're related to sites that they're working on, but this info is up there on the beta version, so they could go there and plug in their parameters and get some info to start off, right?
Yeah, and if feel free to email me if you want to go back to that. You know, if you have specific questions about a particular site, you know, I'm happy to discuss that.
Well, and I just want to point out to everyone who's watching, if you're looking for that URL, on the kind of right middle of your screen, you should see a window or a little box that's called Related URLs. If you don't see that, maybe you're viewing this in full screen. So if you hover your mouse up around the top right of your screen, you should see a little icon that looks like four arrows. That'll either expand your active window or decrease it so that you can see those other windows. So if you go to that Related URLs window, the last link there is for the beta version on Cluin. So that is what Dale's been showing you right now. I think we've got time for just one more question, Dale. Someone asked about if you could speak a little more about the usefulness of NMR and kind of what the strengths and weaknesses are of that tool.
Oh, okay. So NMR is really great for finding water, bound water, immobile water in the subsurface. It's certainly an underutilized tool in the environmental world, but it's great. It can be used for surface and as a surface application, and as well as downhole. As far as identifying contaminant plumes or using them at contaminated sites, we're sort of at the elementary stage of understanding that. It's like I said, it's great for finding water and mobile and immobile water in the subsurface, and can have a lot of applications for understanding contaminant fate and transport. I think that's really all I'm going to say, because I really don't feel myself an expert to speak much more about that. But if you'd like to, I can. If you want to shoot me an email, I'm happy to direct you to some experts in that area. And if someone perhaps has a site, a contaminated site that might be interesting for us to test out some other geophysical tools, certainly in ORD, we're definitely interested in that.
Thanks, Dale. And I think for the person who's asking about that tool, Fred Day Lewis will speak some more about that in 2 weeks from today.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we are just about out of time here, so I want to thank you again, Dale, for that presentation. And if anyone has any questions, they can contact Dale. We've got his information on the website. Let me just real quick remind you guys about his other webinars that we have coming up. Let's see. Okay. Oh, there it is. Okay, sorry. I'm hitting the wrong button. Okay, so on this Thursday, we'll have another geophysics webinar. This one will be with Don Bussey, also from EPA. He's an environmental scientist, and he will be discussing borehole geophysics applied to bedrock hydrogeologic evaluations. That'll be at the same time, 1 p.m. Eastern, this Thursday, the 18th. And 2 weeks from today, we'll have Fred Day Lewis from the U.S. Geological Survey. He's a research hydrologist there. He'll be presenting on geophysical method selection, matching study goals, method capabilities and limitations, and site conditions. You can find these webinars and where to sign up either by the links to the right there under seminar resources, the seminar homepage. You'll be able to register there, or you'll be able to watch the recording depending on when you see this. Those recordings will be available after the fact. Okay, I want to encourage you to stay connected with Kluin. You can find us on social media, and you can sign up for our free monthly newsletter, Tech Direct. You'll get a monthly email telling you all about new webinars and resources related to hazardous waste site cleanup. Thanks again for joining our live webinar today. The slides and other items related to this session can be found on that seminar resources page. This will stay with the seminar indefinitely, so you can access it after the presentation, and you'll also find more information for our speakers and organizers on the presenters page, as we noted earlier. I'd like to ask you to take a brief moment to fill out the online feedback form and let us know what you thought of today's session. Please let us know both about the content covered and the method of delivery. Although we don't offer PDHs or CDUs for our webinars, you can save or print a webinar participation certificate after you submit feedback for the event. Be sure to check the box at the bottom of the feedback form to certify you were here for the entire event or you replayed the complete archive. If you don't check that box, you won't get a certificate. So you can find a copy of your registration email, the seminar slides, and the feedback confirmation email. That should be enough to document your participation in today's event with your own accrediting institution. If you participated as a group, each person can fill out the online form to get their own certificate, and this applies to anyone watching the recorded version of today's session as well. We do look at your comments as we continue to try to improve the content and delivery mechanisms of our webinars. So, and you can also request a confirmation email from the feedback page as a record of your participation in today's event. If you require further assistance, you can feel free to contact Jean Balance. Lastly, today's session was recorded. In the near future, you'll be able to access the slides and hear the presentation as it was given today as part of the archive. You'll automatically receive an email once that archive is available. That's the end of our final reminders. Thank you for joining us today's session.